special.
What's that?
Already lost some.
Well, we got a coin. Okay, we'll open the meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. Welcome, everyone. Just very quickly, we are not going to hear today. We're going to roll over, I should say, Senate Bill 1559 and Senate Bill 1502, and Senate Bill 1501 has been withdrawn, so we will not be talking about that today. So we will start on Senate Bill 1520. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1520 exempts securities that renewable energy cooperative corporations issue to members of the cooperative corporation as evidence of membership or to show members' respective interest in assets, reserves, or patronage dividends from registration requirements. So the measure will become operative July 1st, 2014. Declares an emergency and takes effect upon passage. We have received the Dash 1 Amendment. The Dash 1 Amendment clarifies the definition of renewable energy cooperative corporation for purposes of ORS 59.025. With that amendment, the measure has a minimum fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and so we have all paperwork in hand. We have received a lot of testimony in advance of the hearing. All of that is available on OLIS, Mr. Chair.
And we have one amendment?
Yes, the Dash 1 Amendment.
Okay. Okay, do I have a list? I have a list. Okay, we're going to start off with, okay, I'm not going to do well with this. Dan or Zess? Mark Pengali, you want to come up at the same time and Doris Penwell? We only have three. Oops. No shorter chair. Hold on. Getting one over on the other side. That's all I got. Sure. Who wants to start?
You are.
Mark.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Pengilly. I'm here on behalf of Oregonians for Renewable Energy Progress. Oregon has abundant natural resources across the state, and this bill opens the door for communities to pool their financial resources in developing local energy projects. It's a simple bill. It simply amends ORS 59.025 by adding community renewable energy cooperative corporations to the list of cooperatives that are exempted from securities registration. Many people would like to generate clean energy on their own, but perhaps they lack a sunny roof, perhaps they're a residential tenant, perhaps they don't have enough capital to do it on their own. But as soon as individuals pool their financial resources and there's any expectation of a return on the investment, it becomes a security and they are required to register that security. And this is a process that can involve enormous sums in legal and accounting fees up front, often $50,000 to $100,000 or more. At that point, many of these community renewable energy projects simply stop. People's eyes glaze over and the complexity is too much for them. So this bill would remove that government barrier so that these people could go ahead with their, as a neighborhood, as a congregation, or as a small group. I think you have letters from all over the state, from Umatilla to Lakeview to Portland to Corvallis. And in view of Thursday's hearing cancellation and the agenda today, we've tried to streamline our testimony. But I do want to take a moment to discuss the Dash 1 amendments. The original draft in subparagraph 12 mentioned selling electricity to retail consumers. That is deleted by the Dash 1 amendments. And the original draft said that this would be for solar and renewable energy provided by the movement of wind and water. That has been taken out, and we have referred to existing statutory definitions of renewable energy sources to keep things simpler. Specifically, the language that is referred to in ORS 757-600 would enable electricity generation by these cooperatives that was fueled by wind, waste, solar, geothermal, non-toxic biomass, biogas, hydro facilities, and wave and ocean and thermal energy. I think the Department of Consumer and Business Services may want to add sidebars to the statute in rulemaking. Perhaps they will testify on that point, but it's a simple bill, but it promises enormous benefits to people all over the state, and we ask your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next?
I'll go next.
Thank you, Doris.
I'm Doris Penwell, representing two organizations, the Association of Counties and an organization called the Community Renewable Energy Association. Both organizations are in support of this bill with the Dash 1 amendments. Some years ago, we formed the Community Renewable Energy Association because we were interested in energy development of all sizes, but particularly the smaller scale, because it was local investment that we were looking for, and hope because it's, the return on investment is much better when it's created in the state, as you know, and the money stays in the state, and the generation helps the community, whether it's any kind of an organization. So we're definitely in support of this kind of bill. This small change to the statute will not remove all the little barriers that keep the organizations from moving ahead, but it is one of the few things that we hope we can do to make it possible for these things to happen. So all I can say is we hope you will support us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Dan Orzek. I'm from Corvallis, and I'd like to share some of my experience with financing solar projects in Oregon. I should say, actually, my failure in financing solar projects in Oregon, in the hopes that this will give you some insight into why this bill, I think, is very valuable to the state. I'm a solar developer and a consultant to other solar developers. I work with projects in all the major solar markets in the country, California, Arizona, Nevada, New York, New Jersey, Hawaii. I work with investors in the U.S., Europe, Asia. These include traditional banks, private equity investors, solar panel manufacturers, and a number of other different types of investors, venture capital groups. From their point of view, Oregon is simply a black hole. It doesn't exist. They're only interested in the returns, and Oregon, the market here is essentially too small for them. So why should we care? Because it has a direct impact on the economy and jobs. And I'll give you one example from my personal experience. I developed a project for a large nonprofit in Portland. We received 10 kW feed-in tariff awards. From an investor's viewpoint, this organization is an ideal candidate for a third-party investment, for a third-party to put solar on their roof. Stable, been around for several decades, own dozens of large buildings, develop housing for seniors and low income. I worked with investors for probably at least 6 months, maybe longer, and I couldn't find anyone in the country interested in financing this project. So there is no solar today on the roofs of these buildings. So does that mean that no investors are interested in solar in Oregon? I think not. There's actually, I think there is a homegrown pool of investment capital that we are not making use of. So I submitted some written testimony, and you can look at the specifics, but there was a survey done by the Energy Action Team in Corvallis, part of the Sustainability Coalition there, and I believe we got 360-some responses. This is to survey people's interest in community solar. And of those, more than 250 expressed interest in investing in a local solar project. Now, this is not a scientific survey, but we don't know how much these people were interested in investing. But still, we know that there is a sizable pool of people who would like to invest in solar and under current law are not allowed to. So what I would request is that you pass SB 1520 and allow these investors to invest in their community. Thank you.
Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1520? One more. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Tatman, and I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, the above-mentioned agency that regulates the sale of securities in the state of Oregon. And so it's been our agency that's talked briefly with Mr. Pangeli and others about this. And I just want to raise a couple of points. Obviously, the state doesn't have an issue or does not weigh in one way or the other on this matter, but a couple of things have come up. There's an inconsistency with the clause within the bill that talks about the nature of the dividends that could be paid. It talks about patronage dividends, yet the bill itself talks about dividends in general. It's a broad difference. Cooperatives deal in patronage dividends because people in cooperatives are people who are engaged in usually the activity involved. So, for instance, farmer cooperatives, fishermen cooperatives, timber cooperatives, even grocery cooperatives. People are actually engaged. They're on the inside. They know what's coming in. For their labor, whether it's sweat, equity, or product, or whatever, they then get a patronage dividend back. I'm not sure that applies here or not, but there's an inconsistency. And so I would just bring that to the attention of this committee and make sure that...
David, is that something the division could clarify through administrative rule?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. That's one of our concerns, is that there are, sometimes we can clarify that, sometimes we can't. It says dividend. Now, we could say dividend intended to mean patronage, and possibly if the committee put that on the record, we would then say that was the intent of the legislature. Others would say they knew they wanted dividend versus patronage. They made a distinction between one and the other. It's not for the state to interpret it that way. That would certainly be something we would do because we think that's what is intended. On a broader note, though, there are a number of ways that securities can be sold in the state without registration. The last gentleman that spoke from dealing with investors in New York and across the country talked about people who were investment fund managers, banks, and the like. All those people could invest in any one of these products without the need for the product to be registered. Registration exists to protect the small investors, the people that would be in the community, the people that would be participating, those 350-odd people in Corvallis that might be interested in looking at this. Our biggest concern is not the concept that Mr. Pangeli is bringing forward. It's a pretty interesting concept, and I think it's got merit. Our biggest concern are the people that will look at this new law and say, wow, I can drive a truck through that by developing something to promote something that is illegal and take people's money away. And we've got to make sure we've got those sideboards. So we appreciate Mr. Pangeli acknowledging that with the committee, but that's something we want to take a strong look at. Given the length of time we have to address this matter, I think the best thing for us to do is just try and put on the record that, for instance, dividends should be patronage dividends, and that there is a need to make sure that people are protected. And it may be that the cooperative corporations will provide for some of that. Most cooperatives are different than what we're describing here, though. As I said, most of them have to do with you've got an ongoing relationship with the people you work with, and more particularly, you're usually engaged in the industry involved, whether you're a farmer or a fisherman and alike. You understand what's going on. When we bring in people on the outside that don't have that type of understanding, then they're dependent on the promoters. We want to make sure that those promoters are honest. In this case, I don't question that. But in other cases that come down the road, we want to be able to make sure we can protect Oregonians.
Senator?
Thank you. I had the misfortune of investing in SunWest, so I'm a little bit familiar with securities fraud and how easy it is to drive a Mack truck through it. I think it's essential. I like the bill and I like the concept, but it seems like maybe we somehow... I hate sending it over to the House and tell them to clean it up. I know we're under strict deadlines, but I would want to make sure that the laws are there so the public is taken care of, because that is a real problem out there, and there are people that can make use of that. Now, I don't know who do you foresee as being the oversight for this if this legislation passes?
Chairman Beyer and Senator Gerard, we would still be the oversight. What we would be doing, though, is we'd be fighting with one hand behind our back. The registration piece is the simplest way to knock out fraudulent matters. We don't have to get into the fraud. We don't have to spend 4 years putting a case together like we did in SunWest. We can still look at if there is fraud behind the scene, but that takes a lot more work. The registration piece gives us a lot of prophylactic protections for consumers up front. We would still be the place to go. And frankly, if someone wasn't a legitimate cooperative corporation, we probably could say that exemption does not apply, and therefore you'll have to register to sell your product. So there are some protections. I just think part of it is making sure we understand the intention in this case and that those sideboards exist down the road. It isn't today's issue that we're worried about. It's what happens down the road, because as soon as that law passes, people will be thinking about ways to use it for their own gain.
Well, not to quote what happened in SunWest, but, you know, I mean, exorbitant salaries, you know, paying yourself to negotiate loans, all those things came into the SunWest fraud case. So, you know, I'm really cognizant of that. I like the approach, but I share your concerns.
David, but these are using the term here, and I have not checked this. It's a cooperative, so it would fall within under the cooperative's statutes, not the general C Corp statutes investment. There's a little bit of difference there.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There are differences. The differences exist, but there are. For instance, you don't have to be a member of the cooperative to buy stock in a cooperative corporation. There are all kinds of areas out there. Again, that's not the nature of what these gentlemen are proposing, but by creating that exemption, you may be opening the door for others that have less scruples, if you will. I would recommend that if we just put on the record what I have and then talk with them between now and the time of the Senate, with the House committee, we'll have a chance to work through some of that with the understanding that possibly has to come back to the Senate for...
So I think we have your comment about the patronage dividends. What was the second point?
Well, I think I want to make sure I understand what it is that people are going to be doing to be in that cooperative. Most cooperatives, I said, you're an insider. You are somebody that engages in that trade. You understand the nature of the business. The 350 people down in Corvallis, they're going to be just the average citizen that's going to say, I believe in solar energy or whatever the energy source was. I want to invest in that. But that's no different than wanting to invest in Apple or any other startup company. People have to be protected just so they get sufficient information. Registration exists to ensure that the public is told about just what Senator Girard said, what the salaries are going to be, what are the potential pitfalls, how is it that you might lose your money, how much should you invest if you cannot afford it. If you look at all the other cooperative exemptions, because there are three others, there's either a limitation on how much you can invest or that it expects you to be somebody who's on the inside, either as a fisherman, farmer, or alike. So this is a little bit different, and I just want to make sure we understand who can come in and that they will have sufficient understanding about what they're getting involved in.
My assumption, I was looking at Mr. Pentagelli, is that participants in these type of cooperatives would be customers. They would be recipients of the renewable power being generated. So that would be similar to an agricultural cooperative.
Mr. Chair, I would agree, but that's just the kind of thing we want understood, and so maybe that's what we need to have that conversation about.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate this and this dialogue. I think it's important. I think it's one that we can work to make sure that we get issues like this on the record on the Senate floor when this bill comes across, and we can continue to have the dialogue and see if there's additional fine-tuning amendments that we can make on the House side to make it explicitly clear. So I, again, recognizing the timelines we're under, maybe in a regular, longer session, we would work the bill maybe a little bit more here. But at this point, I'd prefer that we move the bill forward and continue the conversations. Let's get some things on the record on the Senate floor and work with our colleagues in the House to...
I hear that. Any other questions of David? No? Guess not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? I should ask the three of you who are advocating this, did you hear anything? The head nod is fine. That causes you concern? Good enough. Last chance. Anybody else? Okay, we will close the public hearing and open the work session. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1520.
Senator Starr has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1520. Discussion. Senator.
I really feel very strongly that that the public needs to be protected, and I do think that in the House this needs to be looked at a little closer, especially on salaries. You can have a startup company, you can call it whatever you want, but you're paying yourself $400,000. That needs to be disclosed up front. You know, I mean, it just really does. So I'm going to vote because I think the concept's really good. That's one of the problems of being under such tight time constraints that we just don't get it quite the way we want it.
Senator, from my prior experience as a public utility commissioner and having some experience with that, I share your concerns. Ran into a few of those that cost the members of the corporation a lot of money. Colleagues, I think this is a great bill. It doesn't answer all the questions. There are still some questions with regard to net metering, if that comes into it, with regards to the generator restrictions from the Federal Energy Resources Commission. But this deals with just the financing side, and I think it's a good option that we go forward. Any other discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to the that we're on the amendments?
Yes.
Right? To the amendment. Seeing none, the amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair, the bill is amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starrs moves Senate Bill 1520 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Is there any opposition? Senator, I assume you wanted to make your intent clear on those respects?
I thought that we would do that on the Senate floor, but that dividends are patronage dividends.
Uh-huh.
And issues regarding registration are necessary, and we will work with the folks to get those language clarified and potentially fixed in the House.
Disclosure
issues.
I'm just not real comfortable. I'm not really against it, but I just want to throw a little caution flag out.
I think that's a good idea.
Okay, let's be real clear then. Let's do a roll call.
Senator Edwards?
Yes.
Senator
Girard?
Yes.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
I think you missed one. Could
you call?
You. Starr.
Thompson?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
And Chair Biden?
Aye.
Senate Bill 1520, as amended, is passed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Starr will carry. We'll close the public hearing and work session on that, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1547. Representative, welcome, and Commissioner as well.
Oh, man, they let anybody in the building.
be nice.
I was thinking, I just didn't say it out loud.
Thanks. Senator, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. I'm Senator Betsy Close, also co-chair Starr, members of the committee. I brought a bill today called the Youth Employment Act. And this is an opportunity to help our young people get that first-time job. These are the ones that are 14 to 19 and have a hard time just getting that first job and getting some skills that they can then market on their resume. Increasingly, our young people who are seeking to enter the workforce are facing obstacles to getting hired. Companies have become more and more specific in the skills they want an applicant to have, and a first job means everything for someone ages 14 to 19. I actually did this work myself in the 70s, 1978. I worked for Benton County Comprehensive Youth Program, and that was a program that was funded by a CETA grant, which that was a federal act, the Comprehensive Education and Training Act. And they had grants to help young people get their education, get their job skills, work experience, and then also their place on the job trainings. And the grant paid for 50% of their salary for the time that they were trained. It was very successful, and we trained a lot of people. And just to let you know, one of the young gals way back then that I helped was from North Dakota. We placed her in one of these on-the-job trainings. She did that for quite a while. She got her nursing degree, and now she is the head of one of the departments at Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis. So when I saw what Linn County has been doing for years to help young workers gain these skills, first job, I was very encouraged that we in government, together with business, could help our youth receive that crucial on-the-job skills that they need to succeed in their careers. So Senate Bill 1547 would extend this program statewide. A little bit about the bill. The age level is specified at 14 to 19. They have to be legal under the labor laws, of course. The small business employer must have 35 or fewer employees. An employment youth wage agreement is made between the county and the employer. It specifies the county will pay $2 of the wage up to the maximum of $1,000 per youth. So they're getting the full minimum wage or whatever is specified. But the county is picking up a part of that to help with the training. Counties would apply for these grants through the Oregon Business Development Department. The youth is given critical job opportunities, and the overall productivity of the county is improved. It's a win-win. This is not a welfare program. This is a cooperative agreement. And I want to congratulate Linn County for this very innovative alliance with their local businesses. They've been doing this for years, and so I'm welcoming Commissioner Roger Nyquist here today to explain it further. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Claus. Chairman Beyer, Senators, for the record, Roger Nyquist, Chair of the Linn County Board of Commissioners. We've been running this program for a number of years. We use part of the lottery proceeds we receive, and we've employed hundreds of kids with many small businesses in our community, giving these kids the opportunity to learn job skills, working side by side with small business owners. I may be dating myself, but it's the way it used to be when I was growing up and I learned to work. It was from the farmer down the road. In this day and age and these economic times, it's tough for small business owners to hire our youth and, as a practical matter, teach them how to work. By the time they get through that, school starts again, and this is, we're incentivizing that, obviously, by changing the market conditions a little bit through the program, and it works, and I'd encourage your support of it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions? Senator Thompson?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. It says that you limited it to like $1,000 per employee.
Right.
But you had no cap on the total amount. Did you ever?
For an employer, yeah, the cap would be $3,000.
But I mean to the total budget. So you never had to deal with like $100,000?
No, we budgeted $50,000, okay. And we generally came in at less than that.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Others?
So
thank you very much.
Well, I have a clarifying question.
Senator Edwards. Sorry.
So this bill is an authorization, or is this bill money?
There's no appropriation attached to it.
There's no appropriation.
Senator Edwards, they would be grants. That department would have to, it would be within their budget. They'd have to budget for that.
Okay. So state money.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. But, Senator, the bill itself doesn't have a dollar amount in it.
Right.
It does not.
Okay.
So, in essence, it's an authorizing. You'd have to go through a budget process. Okay, cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Let's see here. Alana. In fact, why don't we have, we can get all three of you. Alana, Marcia Kelly, and John.
Mr. Chair, Alana is next door testifying at this moment.
All right, we'll catch her.
Back.
Okay. Well, we'll start with you two then. We've got a lot of bills to move through today. Marcia.
Chair Beyer, Members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. We have about 2,000 members in Oregon. The only requirement for membership is having an AA degree or higher. I share some of Senator Thompson's concerns regarding a cap on this program. It has no sideboards. And although it's a great idea to get youth employed, I'm wondering whether the expense for the state should be put into more money for education, more money for community colleges. I had an intern, a volunteer intern, when I was running an office at one point, and she developed great job skills. She was 13, so she wasn't really... Her father wanted her to volunteer, and I think that trying to provide volunteer opportunities for youth, if you have them, would be a way that we could encourage youth getting job skills without costing the state money that would otherwise hopefully go into community colleges, K through 12, or the really important thing, preschool, so that we really finally will get to the 40-40-20. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Let John testify, and then I'll ask.
Go ahead, John.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. As it was stated earlier, Alana Guinea had planned to testify. She's next door or somewhere else testifying on another bill. If she gets back and has the opportunity, she'd like to speak, and if not, she'll submit testimony in writing. I'll keep my remarks brief. And obviously I believe in youth employment and kids going out and learning job skills. I just have real concerns about how the bill is structured. Excuse me, and having the state subsidize employers, I just think that I question if that's a useful and a productive way for the state to spend their dollars. Thank you.
Sure, sir.
So I'm the father of a couple of teenagers, and I'd love for them to get out of the house in the summertime and go work. They need it, and to some degree they help on their grandparents' farm. But they aren't worth the minimum wage. They are not worth somebody paying them the minimum wage. When they start on a job, most teenage kids aren't worth getting $9 an hour or whatever the minimum wage is. They're just not. And we are doing our children a huge disservice by not creating opportunities for these kids to get out and work. I don't know what the answer is. If this isn't the answer, show me something it is, and don't just say, no, we can't do anything about it, and we're just going to say the minimum wage is the minimum wage, and if you have to wait until you're 18 and have a college degree and have some volunteer experience interning somewhere, because that's not an answer. So help me understand what the answer is. When you want a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, 16-year-old kid to learn the value of showing up on time, to learn, whatever it is that you learn in that first job, I think it's valuable to employers in the long run, but they're not worth, what's the minimum wage today? John, what is it, 9.18?
Low nines, I believe. Excuse me. Yes.
So they're not worth $9 an hour, plus then all the additional things that an employer has to pay.
Are they worth $8?
Well, I'll guarantee you that in the market, in a real market situation, they're surely not worth $9 an hour.
Just to point out, Senator Starr, this program, as I understand it, they still get minimum wage.
They do.
The employee gets minimum wage,
like
just the county
program.
Pays too.
They don't like this program, so give me an alternative that says, how are we going to get 14, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds out in the workforce so they can learn the value of a job and the skills that are required to be productive in the workforce in the long run?
Okay. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Starr, I don't know that this answers your question, but... I honestly believe that some of this is just reflective of the economic state that we're in. I think 5 or 6 years ago, when the economy was in much better shape, pretty much anybody that went out and applied for a job could get one. That sadly has not been the case for the last 5 or 6 years, and I hope as the economy it continues to improve that that'll turn again and there'll be more opportunities out there for more people to go to work at entry-level jobs.
Okay.
Other questions? Senator?
I just have a comment. And I would have to agree with Senator Starr, but I maybe come from a different generation. I had my first job when I was 8 years old. And I worked for my dad in a grocery store. I got paid 50 cents an hour. If I didn't like it, I could go pick berries or go pick beans, which kids can't do now either. So it seems to me that somewhere the new generation, if you will, has never been taught the need to work and the responsibility, as Senator Starr said, of showing up on time. And we're kind of pulling our hair out going, what can we do to get more youth employed and get them going down the track of being a responsible worker? And so maybe the bill's not perfect, but I actually think this is a pretty good bill.
Others? Well, I would just comment that this is not a new idea. The federal government has been funding these kinds of youth experiences since the 1960s. In fact, I guess if you want to go all the way back to the 1930s, there was a whole lot of public paid for employment of kids, the Youth Conservation Corps, which still exists today in this state. The state has a Youth Conservation Corps, and there's a separate funded one that operates out of Eugene, does the same thing. So it's nothing new that we're proposing here. I think the difference, what's novel about this one, to the extent that it is that the county is paying a portion of the wage to the employer directly. So, I mean, that's kind of the difference in it. The real question, I think, that it comes down to is more one of priorities, use of resources, which Marcia got to. I mean, that's going to be the issue. So.
And, excuse me, Senator Beyer, I believe in the bill. It's not the money goes through the county, but the money is state money that's appropriated to the Oregon Business Development Department.
You are correct. I'm saying the model is a Linn County model where they're using their money.
And it was their choice.
The proposal is to create a state program.
Right. Correct.
Again, I would say that there is a state program that passes through federal money now to do something very similar, different forms.
Senator, I'd just like to offer my two bits and say that I've been thinking a long time.
Can you get up to $2?
Yeah, $2. $2. Offer my $2.
How much is two bits?
25 cents.
I know.
I've been searching for ways to try to get kids involved in the workforce earlier for many of the same reasons that we talked about today. When my kids were young, I mean, when I was young, when I was 10, I had to work. I didn't have any choice. So when my kids were 10, I said, okay, you're going to do the same thing because I had to, you have to. But it also means if you have kids out there working, I had to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning, have everything ready to go. I had to supervise them all day. I only let them work 4 hours a day because that's all I wanted to supervise them. So they take a lot more work. You're doing a lot of training. And it was great experience for my kids and some of their friends. And those kids have gone on day and they've learned. My biggest thing was they showed up on time. And they've learned that and they continue that through the rest of their life. And a lot of the kids these days aren't getting this experience. I think this might not be the best way, but it's the best I've seen, and I'm going to support it. And we can worry about the funding later, because we know that probably isn't going to happen this session, but in the future. Thanks.
Okay, is everybody on the record that wants to be on the record now? All right. Thank you very much. So Alana's not here. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on this bill. And moving up next, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1549. This time, Patrick, I'll remember.
Well, that's okay. Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1549 clarifies that statutory provisions regulating investigators do not apply to persons authorized to engage in public accountancy in Oregon. It has an emergency clause that would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. The measure as drafted, we have no amendments, and the measure as drafted has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Thank you. What have we got here? Rob Moody. Actually, we get the whole bunch. Martin Pitoni. See if I did that right. And Brian Henson.
Gentlemen, whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Moody, and I'm a CPA licensed in the state of Oregon. I know that you already have our testimony or my testimony, so let me just briefly summarize what it is we're seeking here today, which is an exemption for CPAs and their employees from the requirements of ORS 703.411. The analysis and evaluation of financial data has long been a customary and traditional part of any CPA practice. And CPAs in Oregon are currently licensed under the State Board of Accountancy, and we believe that it was not the intent of ORS 703.411 to require any dual licensure on the part of CPAs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Petioni. Here is the Executive Director for the Board of Accountancy, and I'm testifying in favor of this bill with support of the Governor's Office for a formal policy position in favor. I'm not going to read my written testimony to you. I just want to highlight to you one or two brief bullet points as to why the Board is involved in this bill here in support and why I've been privileged to kind of be involved in helping develop this bill over the past six or seven months. Basically, for the board, this bill also helps solve an operational problem. One of the essential tools that the board has to protect the public is to not just have investigators on staff, but to also have contract investigators that we bring in. It's an essential tool for the variety of cases that we have, the complexity of cases that we have. It's not so easy to find these folks, and it's quite frankly something that concerned me when I found out that we may have a problem here with having our contract investigators possibly be subject to a dual licensure requirement. DPSST, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, was very nice when I approached them about this issue, and we kind of have a gentleman's agreement in place, but there's kind of a general understanding that it would be better for us as a whole to basically extend the public policy that's already there in the statute that basically says if you are in a licensed profession such as engineering or being a licensed lawyer, that the same thing really should apply for the public accountants as well. That is also from a regulatory perspective, quite frankly, rather consistent with what goes on around the country in those states that require licensure for private investigators, that these types of exemptions are in place. So all we're really asking is that that exemption be extended to that particular profession, and with that you also help out a state agency here in terms of its ability to protect the public, and those are really just the basic points that I would like to leave you with.
Thank you. Mr. Henson.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I'm here. My name is Brian Henson. For the record, I am currently the director of the Facilities and Information Technology Division at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and acting program manager for the Private Security Private Investigators Licensing Program.
Did you get all of that on a business card?
Yeah.
That's a pale
one.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, what I'm here today to share with all of you is that we did just want to say, as the agency that is currently administering the licensing program for private investigators, we are working in collaboration with the Board of Accountancy on this bill. We too agree that the Board of Accountancy is probably what the legislature intended to oversee the regulation of this particular profession, and that it would be in line with the way that we're currently administering the program to not be putting our own regulation over the top of this profession.
This falls under what we call euphemistically a technical fix. Questions of this panel? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1549? Going once, twice, we're done. Okay, we will close the public.
I'm going to move it, or are you going to wait?
I'm going to move it.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1549 and open a work session on 1549. Chair moves 1549 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 1549 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Does anybody want to carry it? Sure. Senator Monroe wishes to carry
it. I'd be happy to carry it.
All right. Senator Monroe will carry. Closed on 1549, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1558. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1558 authorizes the director of DCBS to pay compensation due to workers of members of certain decertified self-insured employer groups and set standards by rule of proof of financial viability of self-insured employers, et cetera, et cetera. I would go on, but I have a long paragraph. I will just save it and allow the folks that really know what they're talking about to come up and give the explanation. Mr. Chair, just as a clarification, this was one of our committee bills from the interim. We've heard it as an informational meeting in November and in January, so it should be relatively fresh in our minds.
I think so, too.
We do have a -1 amendment and a -2 amendment. We have indeterminate fiscal impacts and no revenue impacts for both of those amendments. They do not, neither amendment would require a referral to the Ways and Means Committee, okay. So they go to the floor.
Mr. Allen and Mr. Schultz, let's start out with you. We've heard the bill before. You want to address the two amendments?
Yes, thank you, Chair Byer, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm joined by John Schultz, who's the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. And to the two amendments, the -1 amendment was based on our outreach to stakeholders as the bill came out of LC as originally drafted. We received a number of points of input, in particular the notion that as drafted, the time limit for self-insured groups to elect to continue to operate or to take advantage of this orderly exit that we create in the base bill, as well as the time for them to wind up their business if they choose to exit, was too short, and didn't take advantage of existing time renewal times for certain group policies. And so what the -1 amendment does is extend those deadlines out by about 45 days each, and so we go to July 1st as a date for groups to make an election of what they want to do, and September 15th as a deadline for them to try to wind up their business. I can't speak to the motivation of the -2 amendments. I can, however, raise a couple of concerns that we have about them. They take the same approach that we've tried to deal with on the dates, where we listened to stakeholder input and went as far as we thought we prudently could, take those dates yet further. The September 15th wind-up date that we proposed is a December 31st wind-up date. So those end up being about 6 months longer than we had originally proposed in the base bill, and we're concerned about that. Moreover, the -2s also allow us, or in fact direct us, to use the worker benefit fund to not only pay the worker claims that result from these exited groups, but as well pay the administrative costs of the groups themselves, attorneys, accountants, claims administrators, those kinds of things. We think, as drafted, the bill is offering these group members who wish to exit a generous deal that gets them off the joint and several liability hook that they're currently on for these claims, and we think the groups themselves retaining responsibility for those administrative costs is a reasonable bargain in the issue. With that, I'd be happy to answer any easy questions, and John would take the hard ones.
And Pat, has MLAC
and
taken a position on the bill and the two amendments?
Yeah, I apologize. I meant to address that. Management Labor Advisory Committee has considered the base bill, the -1 amendments, and the -2 amendments, and supports the bill with the -1 amendments. They considered but chose not to support the -2 amendments.
Okay. Questions of John or Pat? Senator Gerard?
Yeah, I just retired, and when I retired, my malpractice, I had to buy, I don't know what they call a tail end insurance policy. Is this going to be sort of modeled after that, or what kind of, where are we? I mean, I had to pay, I don't know, $2,500. That gave me insurance for 5 years and takes care of any malpractice that I have during.
Yes, Chair Byer, Senator Gerard, this is broadly similar to that kind of a concept where the worker benefit fund would be responsible for that tail, which, as you know, with workers' compensation claims, can extend out for quite a long while. It has a very sharp drop to it as you get through the initial injury and treatment and those kinds of issues, but the indemnity tail can extend, and this really is taking that kind of a role exactly.
Senator Stern.
So, appreciate your testimony, appreciate the work. I recognize this is you know, trying to make the best of a pretty ugly kind of situation. The Dash 2 amendments were submitted by me on behalf of a constituent of mine. And can you just, I know you already did it, but can you go again and kind of just tell me, the committee, why the Dash 2 amendments created a problem and are unworkable, in your opinion?
Two reasons, one fairly small, one fairly significant. The fairly small reason is we've really tried, well, I should back up a step and say, from a procedural standpoint, at about July 1st, we go out to existing groups and we review and refresh the amount of deposit they're required to maintain with us. And so our original bill draft tried to have all of this work done prior to that point, so that we didn't need to go to look to a group that might be liquidating and make a change to their deposit, particularly an increase to their deposit, because we take that deposit as a part of their orderly liquidation from the system. We got significant stakeholder feedback that that time frame was too short, and so we came back with a Dash 1 amendment that tried to deal with how far did we think we could prudently push that date without creating more problems. We think we did that with the Dash 1s. The Dash 2s go quite a bit further than that. It's short months from a calendar standpoint, but we get quite far into data that we're basing deposits on data that's at that point 2.5 years old, and that's a difficult place to be. That, as I said, is the more minor concern. The larger concern is that what the Dash 2s do, we believe, is require us to pay not just the claims for worker injuries and worker income replacement, but also the group administrative costs, accountants, attorneys, claims administrators, all those things that go with running your group, and we use the worker benefit fund to do that. We believe that already taking the employers who are completely on the hook for all of it, including the claims, off the hook for those claims, and leaving them responsible to clean up the remaining business of the group is a fair trade in the circumstance, and that it would be very difficult to try to sell to the broad array of stakeholders on this bill that the worker benefit fund should be used to pay those claims costs, or administrative costs, excuse me.
Just follow up, Mr. Chair.
Oh, go ahead.
So you suggest that all that work be done for free, that nobody gets paid for it?
No, Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, not at all. Right now, those group members are responsible for all of those costs. Today, they have to pay those administrative costs, those attorney's fees, accountants, whatever, as well as all of the claims. And so what the bill does is has the worker benefit fund take most of the burden off of them, because the claims represent the largest share of the burden, and leaves the small amount that's the business cost left that they're already obligated for, and just simply doesn't get them off the hook for that.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Is Mr. Wilson here? J.L. Wilson? Don't see him from AOI.
He was a second ago.
He was a minute ago. Mr. Batten? I'm just going down the list.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee. My name is Michael Ballin, and pursuant to a court order by the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon, I was appointed as a plan agent for the Oregon Contractors Workers' Compensation Trust, one of the previously decertified trusts. I'm here to support this bill and provide you with a brief history of this trust, the Chapter 11 plan, and the post-confirmation results. A brief history: in 1997, the Oregon Contractors Workers' Compensation Trust began providing workers' compensation insurance to its members. By 2007, the trust had grown to 383 members with annual member contributions in excess of $13 million. In late 2008, the decline of the economy began to severely impact construction and related sectors, and therefore contributions to the trust, which is based upon the payroll of its members, began to decline. During 2010, the situation worsened. Memberships decreased to 240 members with contributions of about $5 million by the end of 2010. The end result was the trust monthly revenue was less than the monthly obligations, claims obligations, and administrative expenses, and did not have the capital to sustain this negative cash flow. In November 2010, the trust board, after thoroughly considering all options and after consulting with its administrators, legal advisors, DCBS, determined that Chapter 11 was the most appropriate and efficient vehicle for winding up the affairs of the trust. In January 3rd, 2011, the trust filed a voluntary petition and a and as an efficient vehicle for winding up the affairs of the trust. The Chapter 11 plan, the trust confirmed their Chapter 11 plan on December 6, 2011. The plan set forth that the trust would pay all of its obligations in full, including paying all workers' compensation claims and its ongoing expenses and liabilities for its from its current assets and from one or more assessments imposed to its members. The initial assessment that was imposed upon its members was $4.3 million. I was appointed post-confirmation. With that, as of December 31st, the trust had collected approximately, as of December 31st, that's the most current date, the trust had collected approximately $3.3 million of the $4.3 million assessment, with approximately $850,000 being uncollectible. That's approximately 20%. The legal and administrative cost for implementing this assessment was approximately $378,000, and the legal fees for the Chapter 11 plan was $217,000, for a total of $595,000, or almost 14% of the assessment. As of December 31st, 2013, the trust had approximately $1,043,000 in cash. That's to pay claims and administrative expenses. Actual and projected claims liabilities are estimated at $2,674,000, with 26 open claims, at a monthly burn rate of about $150,000 per month. Presently, the trust is facing another assessment of its members in an amount to be determined, but estimated to be $2,290,000, taking into consideration legal and administrative and later related costs. In summary, the history of the trust and the impact it's had on its members can best be summarized as unintended consequences. The members intended to minimize their operating costs by providing their employees and insurance coverage at the lowest possible rate. Like many, the trust did not anticipate the economic downturn and the impact that it would have on the construction industry as a whole, and did not have the capital to absorb the decrease in premium revenue. It is my impression that many members were not fully aware of the contractual liability pursuant to the terms and conditions of the membership agreement that they signed. Whether this being part of contract amnesia or inadequate disclosure, it remains that these members desire finality of this obligation. Even if the members were fully aware of their legal liability, I'm confident that they did not consider the long-term economic impact it would have on them if the trust becomes insolvent. In closing, passage of this bill will allow the trust to be dissolved and for me to be out of a job. It allow its members to be relieved of their long-term liability. It will provide assurance to these injured workers that their claims will be paid. And most importantly, passage of this bill will minimize the cost of other similar trusts who elect to decertify if, in fact, that is their chosen path. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That, Mr. Wilson is not here. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1558?
AOI's testimony is on.
AOI's is on.
Yeah, right here.
Yeah, good enough. All righty, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1558. I think this is a reasonable compromise that the department has worked out. You could easily call it a small bailout. Senator Stark.
Yeah, on behalf of my constituents, that and again, there's online testimony from Todd Henley. I'm going to move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 1558.
Okay. Discussion on Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendments to 1558. Is there discussion? I would just say I appreciate the concern he's raising. I think the structure of the deal as it's proposed by the department is more than fair, and personally will be opposing the Dash 2. Other discussion? Let's do a roll call.
Senator
Edwards? Nope.
Senator Girard?
No.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Monroe?
No.
Senator, or Vice Chair
No. The dash 2s fail. Senator Starr?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 1 amendments to the bill.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1558. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion? The dash 1s are adopted. Senator Starr?
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended by the dash 1 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 1558 as amended by the dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 1558, as amended by the dash 1s, is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody want to carry? Chair will carry. We'll close on 1558. Right, let me just check my list here. What else do we have? That's it, isn't it?
Mr. Chair?
Huh?
I was just planning to take action on 1547.
Not today.
Because I didn't get a chance to give my little negative speech on it.
You want to give a negative speech on it?
Well, I will when we, if and when we call a vote on it.
Okay. So we have...
just announced we're carrying over...
We are carrying over Senate Bill 1559 and 1502.
It's terrible, isn't it?
With that, is there anything further for the committee? How about that? We got through all of this in an hour. We are adjourned.
That's pretty good.
We are adjourned.
That's pretty good.